Well, here's where we're heading today. We're going to spend the first few minutes talking about PARP inhibitors in general, how they work, what kind of efficacy you see, and also the issue in terms of side effects and toxicity. And then we're going to talk a bit about each one of these four cancers in terms of what kind of research has been done on PARP inhibitors, what it showed, and how it's affected clinical patient care. So let's start out talking about, you know, sort of PARP inhibitors in general. And we want to talk about, first of all, kind of how they work, and then we'll kind of get into how you figure out whether a patient might benefit from that based on the kind of genomic profile they have, the type of profiles. Can you do a liquid biopsy as opposed to a tissue biopsy? We're going to talk a little bit about sort of how these agents actually work and which ones are approved. And just to get started, Katie, we pulled a couple of slides that you went through in terms of sort of the mechanism of what's going on. And again, if you really want to see the granularity of this played out, you can watch Katie's presentation when we post it. But maybe just sort of summarize, Katie, how this works.
So I think one thing that's really helpful when you're talking about PARP inhibitors with patients is often they or their families will come back around and go, you know, how does this work? Why are you interested in this particular drug for my mom or sister or wife? And so just thinking about cancer in general, cancer cells are replicating very, very quickly. They have lots of mutations, as you know. As they replicate, they make lots of mistakes and they have to fix themselves. And there's a numerous on the prior slide, you could see there's many ways that our system is created to do surveillance and see these errors and fix them. And so the key ones, there's many that are important, but the key ones that we talk about a lot with ovarian cancer and breast and prostate, you know, my colleagues will speak about it as well, are repair of single strand breaks and double strand breaks that you can see bolded. And why is that? Well, there's many reasons, but for ovarian cancer cells don't do this well. So they struggle to fix these mutations. And they use the protein PARP, which you can see there in red. And they use the proteins BRCA1 and 2, which you can see on the right side in red. Those are key proteins in fixing DNA. And so they're great targets for us. And so if we keep going and you think about a single strand break on DNA, which happens all the time, it's happening right now in every cell in your body. It's sort of scary to think about, but we're really good at fixing it. So PARP, when it sees a single strand break, and you can see it there as the purple ball, will stick to the DNA. PARP is poly-ADP ribose polymerase. So it creates these chains, these polymers, kind of a scaffolding, so that those proteins, that little bundle of proteins you see in the bottom left-hand side, can come up, bind to the site, the PARP will release, and those little DNA proteins will, repair proteins will fix it, and the cell goes on as normal. And so when you think about using a PARP inhibitor, which is here in the orange kind of odd dumbbell size shaped figure, the PARP inhibitor will come and bind to the PARP protein while it's on that single strand DNA break and prevent it from releasing. Remember I said once it recruits those protein, it has to pop off. If it can't pop off, then that replication fork that's coming down, you see that in the upper right-hand side, kind of runs into, it's like running into a wad of gum. It can't progress. You get double strand breaks, and now you revert to need for double strand break repair. So if you have a cell that's really good at fixing its double strand breaks, like a normal cell, your non-cancerous cell, it doesn't care. It's going to fix those double strand breaks and live. But if you have a cell that already struggles to fix its double strand breaks, like a patient with a BRCA-associated cancer or a PALB2 or RAD51, and there's a number of ways that this happens, and then you take out that PARP protein as well, it's kind of like taking two legs off a three-legged stool and the cell will die. So you hit a vulnerable cell kind of where it counts and you can take that cell out.
I was just going to ask Mike to comment a little bit. One of the central themes, and we've already mentioned it a couple times, is the issue of somatic versus germline mutation. Mike, can you talk a little bit about what the difference is and does it affect at all the responsiveness to PARP inhibitors? Joyce was alluding to other germline mutations. Kind of what's the difference between germline and somatic and how does it relate to PARP?
So that's an important question because germline mutations are what a lot of these PARP inhibitor approvals are based on. Germline mutations are mutations that the patient is born with. So it's identified in the normal cells of the body. That's why we test either the normal blood cells, or so if we use a saliva sample, we're using the normal epithelial cells of the mouth. And we're really looking for the genes that the patient was born with and looking for a mutation in one of the genes that may allow for susceptibility to a PARP inhibitor. The somatic mutations are mutations within the tumor itself. And so to identify those, you have to test the tumor. And the tumors tend to have many more mutations than do the patient's germline DNA. The important thing also is about the susceptibility to developing cancer, because a patient with a germline mutation in, for example, a BRCA gene, they can have that DNA repair abnormalities that Dr. Moore just discussed to develop over time into a cancer. They also are theoretically more likely to be susceptible to a PARP inhibitors. But we are finding, certainly in my area of pancreatic cancer, that even patients with somatic-only BRCA gene mutations, they do still respond to PARP inhibitors as well.
So, Emmanuel, we know that there are a number of PARP inhibitors, so we'll take a look at that in a second, that are currently are being approved. But just, you know, in oncology, there are many situations where we have multiple agents within a class. Breast cancer, we have three different CDK inhibitors we've talked about, for example, in our breast cancer program. And if we take a look at this next slide, we see kind of a graph looking at the available PARP inhibitors. Can you talk a little bit, Emmanuel, from your point of view about how these differ biologically? We'll get into clinically how they differ, but from your point of view, how they differ biologically. We have kind of also a summary of this in terms of the FDA approvals, but maybe you can start out first, Emmanuel, with kind of what the difference is between these drugs.
So first of all, Neil, it's always a good thing to have multiple treatment choices. Some people say, do we really need a fourth PARP inhibitor? And I always say, yes, we do, because, you know, in a market such as ours, you create competition, you can hopefully lower prices. That doesn't always happen. And the other thing is, the side effect profiles, of course, could be different, and there might be one PARP inhibitor that is better for one patient versus another. The biological considerations are, does this drug inhibit the PARP enzyme, which is the enzymatic activity? And the second question, as was alluded to by the other speaker, is about the DNA binding, the PARP binding onto the DNA, or sometimes called trapping. And some of these PARP inhibitors are better at trapping the PARP on the DNA, and others are less good at doing that. What we really don't know, Neil, is whether all these biological considerations actually translate into clinical efficacy. And I myself don't think that they do. That's my personal bias. But I think I answered your question.
So in a second, we're going to go through a case and start to bring in, you know, the reality of sort of how this plays out in practice. But just to go back to Gretchen for a second, we were talking before about somatic and germline mutations. And one of the important things about germline mutations, I think we've already alluded to, is the family members and the possibility that by identifying a germline mutation, you might be able to actually avoid a patient having cancer by, for example, having prophylactic mastectomy and oophorectomy. And I'm curious, Gretchen, what kind of responses you get. Some people hesitate to get this type of testing because of, you know, kind of what the implications might be to their family. What your experience has been in that regard?
Based on my experience, patients are pretty receptive and open to doing genetic testing, especially if it will lower down their risk of, you know, cancer recurrence or cancer progressing to a stage 4 disease.
Yeah, we actually have had a couple of patients. I can recall actually a pancreatic patient who died but was found to have a BRCA germline mutation, and his daughter was found to have the mutation too. So theoretically, sort of as a legacy, hopefully he would prevent her from having to go through this experience that he's going through. Let's start to bring this into the real world of cases. As you know, you can look at data, but it always plays out a little bit differently. We're going to start out with an ovarian case. And this is really the leading edge, I think, of where PARP inhibitors are heading in terms of what's going on with ovarian cancer. So, Deb, can you talk a little bit about this patient? When we do this, you know, we're going to emphasize patient education, but also what was different about this particular patient in terms of, do you compare this patient to another person with the same oncology situation, but a different person? Different attitude, different background, different socioeconomic status. So we're going to kind of try to highlight that as we go through these cases. Deb, let's hear about this 47-year-old woman.
Yes, my 47-year-old patient had a long history of GERD and had been found to have a dysfunctional gallbladder. I don't remember if it was sludge or stones, but went in for a routine robotic cholecystectomy. And it was noted that she had diffuse carcinomatosis. She also had some ascites that was noted as well. There was biopsies taken, and she was found to have adenocarcinoma, PEX-8 positive, ERPR positive. And then after she had this routine surgery that showed the cancer, she ended up developing more symptoms of her disease. So she presented to our practice with a large amount of ascites and on imaging bilateral adnexal masses. She was consented and enrolled in one of our investigator-initiated trials. It's a neoadjuvant study with carboplatin paclitaxel and an oral BMI-1 inhibitor. She completed three of those cycles, then underwent interval cytoreductive surgery to no gross residual disease. Her confirmed stage was a stage 3C, and she has a BRCA2 mutation. This patient's mother had just recently completed her own ovarian cancer treatment at the same institution where this patient is currently treating. This patient, however, my patient, had not completed her own genetic testing. She did not complete that until, and then her own offspring or her own son did not complete it until after her diagnosis. So of course, this patient is BRCA2 mutated.
Before you go on, just to stop for a second and go back to Katie in terms of kind of this clinical presentation, we'll talk more after we look at sort of the ovarian trials, but just to sort of place things in context here, Katie, can you talk a little bit? This lady ended up getting neoadjuvant therapy before surgery. Other patients will get surgery first and then systemic therapy. This lady looks like she had a lot of disease in her belly, ascites, peritoneal carcinomatosis. Katie, any comments about how you approach that decision?
So that's kind of one of the first decisions we make when patients present. And this particular patient, very young, very healthy. There was no other reason. Sometimes we don't operate because patients are really medically fragile and the cancer just pushes them over the edge. She had none of those, but she had an incredibly high volume of disease. She's one of my partner's patients in terms of primary oncologic care. So she was taken to the operating room really with the intent of going to primary cytoreduction, but they put a laparoscope in first, and there's a scoring system that we use to try and pour out, and you have an independent surgeon come in and look as well. And it gives you, depending on the score, it gives you a percent likelihood that you're going to remove everything in that patient's abdomen, because that is the goal. And there was just too extensive of disease to proceed. And so biopsies were taken to confirm the diagnosis and have enough for molecular profiling. And she was not opened, which is important. And then just started really immediately on therapy. And she responded beautifully. But the decision really is based on surgeon's ability and the patient's presentation and ability to get that patient to no visible disease.
So I guess the important thing now we want to focus on is, regardless of which way the patient with ovarian cancer gets there, after they've had their surgery, after they've had their adjuvant chemotherapy, the question is, are they going to get maintenance? And we'll talk about the background for why a patient like this would get maintenance therapy with a PARP inhibitor. But can you just talk a little bit about what happened when she got the PARP inhibitor, Deb, or olaparib?
Right. So she completed the study, made the choice to go on maintenance olaparib, 300 milligrams, POBID, and after 2 weeks, she developed some stomatitis. We started some oral care, prescribed the compounded magic mouthwash. This resolved no problem. After 6 weeks, with checking CBCs regularly, she had developed some anemia that she did not, I believe, get transfused when she was on her neoadjuvant therapy, but she developed 7.1 hemoglobin. She had some increased GERD that was quite bothersome even after using proton pump inhibitor, PPI. She was transfused, two transfusions to get her to a hemoglobin of 10, with the decision with the GERD that was quite bothersome to her. It was making it difficult for her to go to work. She was very symptomatic. It was very painful for her. The decision by her primary gynecologic oncologist was to dose reduce the olaparib to 150 milligrams POBID. And it was mostly that was due to the increased GERD symptoms. And these have since resolved. And as of, I believe, just a few weeks ago, she had completed the five cycles, and she's still, of course, treating and considering now a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy with reconstruction.
So a couple points about this case. First of all, curious, Joyce, have you seen stomatitis You actually did a lot of the classic work with the managing stomatitis with everolimus in breast cancer using MAGIC mouthwash and other approaches. Have you seen that with PARP inhibitors, Joyce?
No, I have not seen it. And I would be asking the patient, were they aphthous stomatitis, or the classic canker sores, because those respond so beautifully to oral dexamethasone rinse. And within the context of mTOR inhibitor, the everolimus, you can use that prophylactically from day one. The chemotherapy or cytotoxic-related stomatitis is more of a superficial, a little bit more diffuse, superficial, but not that very, very painful aphthous stomatitis. And then the miracle mouthwashes work really well, you know, that have often antibiotics in them, or some of the antiseptic mouth rinses as well can work quite well too.
I'm kind of curious, you know, it's interesting. This patient has a BRCA germline mutation, which does make her increased risk for breast cancer. On the other hand, she has a very serious cancer right now with a poor prognosis. We'll see. Maybe with PARP inhibitor, it'll be better. But I see, Joyce, that this patient's being considered for prophylactic bilateral mastectomy. Sometimes this comes up in other situations with people with metastatic disease. It kind of makes you wonder a little bit. Any thoughts about that, Joyce?
Yeah, one that is something to really give some good thought and obviously speak to her gynecologic oncologist about her overall prognosis and, you know, the likelihood she'll stay NED. But a prophylactic mastectomy with implant placement is pretty straightforward. Surgery, they're avoiding autologous flaps, you know, for example, probably would be prudent in my mind, but having prophylactic mastectomy with even, you know, nipple areolar sparing mastectomy, skin sparing mastectomy, very, very nice cosmetic results and pretty straightforward with implant placement. So not unreasonable in a woman who's looking at years of lifespan.
So Mike, I'm also curious what your thoughts are. We're going to talk more about some of the trials and what they showed in terms of tolerability issues. But this patient had some kind of GI problems, looked like the GERD, and she required some treatment for also cytopenias, requiring transfusion. Mike, any comment about those two issues in the use of PARP inhibitors and also how you see it playing out in patients with pancreatic cancer?
So we definitely, the one randomized trial in pancreatic cancer, which was the POLO phase 3 trial that compared olaparib to placebo, it allowed us at least to assess the side effects of a PARP inhibitor in a pancreatic cancer population. And not surprisingly, there were more GI side effects, more nausea, more anorexia. So it definitely can affect these pancreatic cancer patients who are in general more susceptible to those kinds of side effects. There's also been an outstanding question that I don't think is yet answered as to whether patients with germline BRCA mutations in whom all of the cells in their body lack one of the BRCA genes, whether they're more susceptible to the side effects of these PARP inhibitors. Actually, I saw Dr. Moore in one of our previous sessions. I think she said that she's not seen those in the ovarian cancer patients. She can certainly correct me if I remember that wrong. But I've always been curious to see how that would play out in other disease types.
That's a good point. Actually, Katie, I brought this up the other day in another conference and about the question of, do people with BRCA germline mutations have more toxicity from PARP inhibitors? You know, I remember you in the past saying theoretically you wouldn't expect so. Any comment about sort of why, Katie?
Well, a patient with a germline BRCA mutation, of course, every cell has one allele that's mutated, but the other one is normal. So they should have normal functioning BRCA protein in their normal cells. That's why you don't see a lot of the side effects. So to me, it doesn't make a lot of sense that they would have more, but you have two experts on that I always learn from. Clinically, we've looked at, albeit retrospectively, patients who were on veliparib, paclitaxel, carboplatin, for example, with a BRCA-associated cancer and without, and looked at rates of hematologic toxicities and didn't see any difference really whatsoever. And non-hematologic toxicities didn't seem to vary either, but perhaps that was masked by the fact that they were all getting chemotherapy. It hasn't really been broken out yet, but it could be in the maintenance studies to see if you saw more toxicity. But thus far, the small studies that have been reported haven't shown a difference. My partner's disagreed with that.
I think people really didn't know, actually. Before we go on and talk more about toxicity and tolerability, I want to go back to Emmanuel in terms of the spectrum of genomic alterations where you might see benefit from PARP inhibitors beyond BRCA. So we know that there are other germline mutations, Emmanuel, there are other somatic mutations. some that are being picked up every day, new biomarkers. But Emmanuel, can you kind of provide an overview of who benefits and how you figure that out, looking at testing both the tissue and germline?
So in prostate cancer, we got lucky because we learned from the ovarian and breast cancer experiences. And when we began to develop drugs like olaparib in our disease, we didn't want to pigeonhole ourselves into only looking at BRCA1 or 2. And we did not want to restrict ourselves to germline only as well. So the olaparib study, for example, Neil, encompassed a panel of 15 homologous recombination genes. And those genes mutated at the germline level or the somatic level. And the FDA approval of olaparib for prostate cancer actually includes 14 of the 15 genes. One gene was removed because the outcome seemed to be worse with olaparib versus control in that one gene. But the other 14 genes are there. And again, a germline or somatic mutation is sufficient for the drug to be prescribed. So beyond BRCA1 and BRCA2, we have a gene called PALB2, which stands for partner and localizer of BRCA2. It interacts directly with that gene. We have many of the Fanconi anemia genes, which were discovered in that condition called Fanconi anemia when they are double germline mutations, but you can have a FANCA, a FANCL, a FANCM, a FANCC, and these mutations also may sensitize. And then there are other genes such as CHEK2 or maybe CHEK1. In prostate cancer, there's a gene called CDK12, which is also prevalent in ovarian cancer, but it's pretty much restricted to those two cancer types. And then there are a number of much more rare genes like the RAD51, RAD54, et cetera. Long story short, it goes beyond BRCA1 and BRCA2. And in the prostate cancer indication for olaparib, we have the luxury, so to speak, of prescribing this drug for any of those 14 mutations that are listed on the package insert.
One of the things also we want to try to get into tonight is the typical sort of genomic profile that you see with these four diseases. And coming back to you, Emmanuel, where does prostate cancer fit in terms of sort of its PARPness or its BRCAness? How often do you see germline mutations in men with metastatic prostate cancer? How sort of BRCA or PARP-like is it, say, compared to the other three cancers we're talking about tonight, Emmanuel?
Right. So the PARPness, which is technically known as homologous recombination deficiency or HRD, is about 20% of all metastatic prostate cancers. And half of those are germline. So 10% have a germline HRD defect. Again, when you add all the genes up together. So it's about 1/5 to 1/4 at the somatic level and about 1 in 10 at the germline level.
So we'll get into the other three as we move along.